This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When tracking the impact of a wave, it is best to take the long view. For now, we only know how it looks and feels and how it's interpreted in this moment.
So what I see happening on the streets of Atlanta, this is chaos. A protest has purpose. When Dr. King was assassinated, we didn't do this to our city.
Martin Luther King said, "We have the right to protest for rights." It is regrettable that some of these protests have turned toward violence, but in each instance, local law enforcement has been able to address it.
We will never solve generational systemic injustice with looting, burning, destruction of property, and killing in the name of justice.
A recent Monmouth poll asked respondents about the actions of protesters, including the burning of a police precinct in Minneapolis. 57% said the protesters' anger was fully justified. But as to whether the actions themselves were fully justified, only 17% said yes. That result comes 57 years after Dr. Martin Luther King, writing an open letter from a Birmingham, Alabama jail, scolded white moderates who say, quote, "I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action." That disconnect, wrote political reporter Maggie Astor this week in the New York Times, reveals a fundamental misunderstanding of the dynamics of protest and of American history itself. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In your piece, you wrote about the cycle of public opinion, from anger and derision to sanitization and nostalgia. You say this phenomenon goes at least a century back to the abolition movement, no?
Yes. As far back as the 1830s, there was really violent backlash to abolitionists. There was an incident in Boston, for example, where the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison was literally dragged through the streets of Boston with a rope around his waist by a white mob. Another mob burned down a meeting hall in Philadelphia that was being used by abolitionists. So regardless of what tactics the activists used, there has always been that sort of backlash from people who oppose the aims of a protest movement.
Now let's move onward a little bit to the latter part of the 19th and early 20th century with the women's suffrage movement. School history books and pop culture present a gauzy and, I think, often condescending view of those events. You know, it's just a bunch of flinty, determined women quaintly protesting for a cause that we today view as a no-brainer. But at the time, there was backlash, no?
Yes, absolutely there was. Now, in comparison to many other movements, the tactics that many women suffragists used were more within the realm of traditional electoral politics. They circulated petitions, they held meetings, they lobbied Congress. But there was certainly in the later years of the suffrage movement a very stark split between the more moderate wing that was pursuing those tactics I just mentioned, and a more radical wing that, for example, in February of 1919, burned President Woodrow Wilson in effigy outside the White House. There was a huge amount of criticism of those tactics, but the way that those more radical protesters were treated by the police when they were arrested helped bring public sympathy to the movement. And even for the suffragists who did use those traditional political tactics, the message itself was disruptive. And that did bring a great deal of backlash, even when they were using those very staid traditional political tools.
A majority of Americans, I referred earlier to that Monmouth poll, still believe that polite protest is great, kicking up a ruckus bad, and even more than that, counterproductive. You spoke with a historian whose focus has been on the relationship between so-called intense protest and voter turnout, which is the most fundamental tool of orderly democracy.
The study you're referring to, which was by Daniel Gillian, a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, ranks the intensity of protests on a scale. So, for example, a protest will get 1 point if it involves more than 100 people. It'll get another point if there are arrests made, another point if there are injuries. He found that more intense protests were associated with increased voter turnout among people who were ideologically aligned with the protest. And he also found that intense protests in any given congressional district tended to influence the voting record of that district's congressional representative.
I mentioned earlier the gauzy mythology that's characterized some highly fraught historical moments. On this show, we've more than once revisited the story of young student Rosa Parks in 1955 refusing to move to the back of a Montgomery, Alabama bus. American memory views that episode through rose-colored glasses, does it not?
Yes, certainly the mythology of Rosa Parks is that she was this ordinary woman who was very tired after a long day of work, and she just really didn't want to give up her seat. In reality, she was a longtime activist with the NAACP. She had been deeply involved in investigating a gang rape case of a African-American woman. She was very much steeped in the civil rights movement before that day on the bus, and that stand that she took was a calculated political action. It was not a spur of the moment, she was just tired sort of thing.
So the sum total of this kind of soft-focus revisionism seems to perpetuate a larger myth of frictionless, polite protest. And in doing that, all but obliterates the impact of some truly convulsive events like the Watts riots, the 1968 riots across the country after the assassination of Dr. King, the L.A. rioting after the acquittal of the men who beat Rodney King. What is lost in this process?
Well, it sort of perpetuates this myth that if people just stand up politely and state what is right, then society will change. But if the ideas that a movement was promoting were universally accepted and not controversial, then there wouldn't be any need for the movement to begin with. You know, the protest movements that have been successful are very complicated. They are accumulations of many different people using many different tactics, and it is really impossible to separate out one person and one tactic and say, this is the one that caused the movement to succeed. So this mythology really inhibits our understanding of how movements do achieve their goals and what they actually look like when they're happening.
I'm wondering why the impulse to revise history to match what we think our values are.
Well, I think that certainly there's a tendency for people to believe that if they had been alive during a particular period of history, that they would have stood on the right side. Obviously, that is something that is impossible to know unless you actually were alive during that period in history. During the civil rights movement, a very large subset of the population did not support Dr. King, either his tactics or his message, violently resisted him. That fact is uncomfortable to a society that wants to believe that it would have stood with him.
I am about to share with you an extremely troubling episode of my personal history. This was in 1974. It was summertime, and I was visiting my freshman year college roommate in central Pennsylvania. I was in his family's family room, and above the mantelpiece was a rifle. His father was there. I said, "What's that?" And he says, "Oh, that's a replica of the rifle that killed Martin Luther King."
Wow. I spoke with two of his children for my article, and both of them emphasized that at the time that he was assassinated, he was one of the most disliked people in America, according to polls. He was not the lionized hero that he is today.
Maggie, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Maggie Astor is a political reporter for the New York Times.
Coming up, what if there is an act of such horror that the journalists responsible for history's first draft don't cover it, or worse still, cover it up?
This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.